Chapter 16 is Greek to Me by Willie Snow Etheridge. 16, quote unquote, how wild are the mountains? From Distamon, we go to Delphi. Though we leave Distamon immediately after the lighting of the candles in the cemetery, it is already dark. See, we have no between, Alini says. Costa decides to take a shortcut to the main highway. It is terrific, far worse than a detour through a plowed field in the United States. We are constantly driving hood first into holes of mud and water and floundering out again. But will we always be able to flounder out? None of us talk. Costa has his hands full with the jeep. Eleni is suffering with a fresh cold. She calls it a donkey cold because it is such a hard one. And I am depressed by Distamon. The night is black except for the nose of light sniffing along the road before the jeep. The world is in total darkness. There are mountains I know close to us, but I cannot see where their sides and tops end and the sky begins. There surely must be a storm stirring. Unfortunately, I begin to think of the gorillas. They are in the mountains near here, but are they watching this road? I hope not. It is selfish of me, but I pray they have more important business than the guarding of this highway tonight. We are now in the country of the gorillas, I say to Eleni. I do not think of them, she answers brusquely. We climb around mountain shoulders. We crawl along the ledges of bomb bridges. Suddenly, before us, on the sides of the highway, there is a man. On the side of the highway, there is a man. The headlights shine on the metal of his gun. My heart trips. Will he ask questions before he shoots? Costa does not slow up. He jounces straight ahead, feeling silly. I see it is only a roadside shrine with a small round dome on its top. A fluttering candle flame is the twinkling metal of the gun. Golly, I'm jittery. We bump around another bend, and there in front of us, against the thick velvet draperies of the night, is a star-studded Christmas tree, made unintentionally, of course, by the lights of a town stepping up the steep slopes of a mountain. When we reach it, we careen along the narrow main street which runs, as it were, at the base of the tree. It is filled with men and geese who scatter quickly at the honking of the jeep. Out again into the black night, more climbing of mountains, more chugging around narrow shoulders, and we are in Delphi. The moon will come up too late, if ever, for us to see the antiquities, so we'll have supper and go early to bed. Our hotel is spotlessly clean, but chilly. The rain of the early afternoon and the mountain altitude have pulled the thermometer uncomfortably down. Eleni and I find a restaurant and take ourselves, as usual, to the kitchen. A big wood stove is gloriously hot. I haul a chair into a corner beside it and happily settle down. What will we have to eat? The proprietor shows us a pan of tiny raw fish that had been caught that afternoon in the sea. We will have those, we decide, and a lettuce salad with spring onions, if they are available, and your tea and brown bread. Costa arrives, having locked up the jeep for the night, and joins us as if he is an old friend instead of a chauffeur for the Near East Foundation. It is not the first time I have noticed a Greek's awareness of occupation distinctions. They seem to be truly democratic. They appear to feel no sense of inferiority or superiority. All the men, whether they are peasants, cobblers, policemen, politicians, or bankers, are socially equal. Costa, Eleni, the restaurant proprietor, and the proprietor's wife and I watch the fish fry golden brown and crisp in the deep fat. They smell wonderful. Four are for me, four for Eleni, and six for Costa. We take them to the dining room and begin to eat. The proprietor says he will bring our salad shortly. He goes out the front door and in a few minutes returns, gaily waving a half dozen freshly pulled onions. Then he reappears with our bowls of marulia. The onions, still sparkling with drops of water, adorn them. He does not mention whose garden he has raided. When the rest of the food is on the table, he and his wife pull up chairs near us and watch us eat. Intoxie, they ask, smiling. Intoxie, we chorus. The yurti, which is similar to cottage cheese, is especially delicious. It is made from goat's milk, I ask. No, from sheep's, Eleni answers. I didn't know sheep gave milk, I say truthfully. What did you think little lambs eat? Little lambs eat ivy, I retort, and grin all by myself at the memory of that foolish song. At the last bite of yurti, the most beautiful old man comes in and joins the proprietor and his wife in the watching section. He is the proprietor's father, and his picture in an Effzoni costume hangs on the wall of the restaurant. He has a snow-white mustache as long and stiffly curled as a billy goat's horns, dark, lean, deep, wrinkled cheeks, and snapping black eyes. He cannot now wear his native costume because he has no soap for the white pleated shirt, so is content in a slate-blue coat that reaches his knees, black pants, and a tiny cap. Nevertheless, I promise to give him soap, which I have brought from Kentucky, the first thing in the morning. But the first thing I do in the morning is to go into ecstasies. When I look out of my window, I see a view I cannot believe. I must still be asleep. I open the window, which is really a door, and walk out onto a small balcony and breathe deeply. Yes, I am awake, and the view is real. But you, what of you? I like that, you see, I'm off into poetry. Directly beneath the balcony, the earth opens into a tremendous canyon, thousands of feet deep, and the floor of the canyon, which broadens out on my right until it meets the sea, is puffed like an old-fashioned biscuit quilt with the rounded tops of innumerable olive trees. For a long time, I feast my eyes on those acres of silvery green olives stretching away to the distant silvery sea before I think to look to my left, and then it is that I have to slide down quickly onto the windowsill. Masses of mountains block the canyon, block the sea, block the world. They are black green against the young morning blue, for the sun has not yet scaled their summits. I shiver with cold, but I can't go in. I simply pull my flannel robe more closely around me. I hear the faint tinkle of sheep bells, the rush of water, swooshing it sounds, along the street by the side of the hotel, the clop of horses' hooves, the hurried high voices of children. Where are those children? I get up and peer over the balcony. The drop into the canyon is as precipitous as I first thought. But there is a narrow ledge just beneath me, stacked with the red tile roofs of tiny houses. Over one, a peach tree has broken a comber of foaming pink. I hope the children are there, but I cannot see them. I dress and go to Eleni's room. She is not there, but she comes in a minute and from the direction of the bathroom. I have seen, she announces saucily, where the king has to go on his own 2 feet. We pull a table onto the balcony, and with that soft silvery land of olive trees and that soft silvery stretch of sea beneath us and that majestic mass of mountains above us, we eat thick slices of black bread and white butter and golden honey and drink large cups of Turkish coffee. For the 100th time, I decide never to leave Greece. After breakfast, we start for the ancient ruins of Delphi, but are delayed by the activities at the corner of our hotel. There is a pump there from which a fat stream of water gushes into a cement basin, and then over the sides of the basin into the cobbled street, and down the cobbled street to the brink of the canyon a block away. It is the water I heard swooshing from my balcony. One woman is scrubbing clothes in the basin. One is washing whole kernels of wheat before taking them to the mill to be ground. And a man is soaking long strands of yellow straw. While the straw soaks and grows limber, the man sits flat on the sidewalk, his back against the cream stucco wall of a building, his legs stretched out in a V in front of him, and with nimble brown fingers weaves the seat of a chair from straw already conditioned. Several men stand in the middle of the road watching the three work, and among them is the beautiful old father of the restaurant proprietor. I give him the soap I have promised him, and he tells me about the canyon. It is known as the Valley of the Kings, for in olden days, when kings came with their armies to conquer Delphi, they were hurled from the rim, just a few feet from where we stand, into the depths below, and were happily destroyed. By the time we scramble into the jeep, more men have gathered. They smile warmly upon us, shake our hands, and cry, "Kalo taksidi," good journey. Why they are not working, I will never know. The location of the ruins of Delphi is terrific. They are on a sloping shelf that juts out from two perpendicular cliffs of Parnassus. I stand at the entrance to the ruins and gaze up and up and up to those sheer steeples of gray rock, streaked here and there with red, and I am speechless. But not Eleni. "My God, how wild are the mountains," she exclaims. The ancient Greeks were very clever in selecting the sites for their shrines, were they not? We sit down right where we are on a marble slab and turn our backs on Parnassus. The road skirting the shelf is a few feet away, and then there is only clear air. The land drops abruptly into that same canyon I saw from my balcony, but it is narrower here away from the sea, and the mountains on the far side spring up in straight, gigantic strides to the sky. Lying back on her elbows and looking up, Eleni remarks, "It is the most blue you can have. Happily, it rained yesterday." My eyes swoop from the sky down the long mountainsides to the depths of the canyon, and among the green brush and trees I spy tiny, curving stretches of a river gleaming like silver earrings. "Come, let us go more upstairs," says Eleni. We climb the sloping shelf among broken marble columns, bases of old monuments, slabs of steps, and pieces of statuary. There are many temples here, centuries before Christ, sacred to Apollo, Eleni remarks vaguely. It was started by a goddess, and she had a, I don't know what you call him, maybe a watchman. He was a bad man and blackmailed the people. Apollo came here and killed him, and after that the place was dedicated to Apollo. What became of the goddess? The question takes Eleni by surprise, but quickly she recovers. It is not written in the history. "But something must have happened to her," I persist. "Was she killed too?" "Oh no, a goddess could not be killed." Curious about Eleni's goddess and the watchman, I search the pages of an old Baedeker, which I always carried about with me but usually forget to read. No watchman is mentioned, but there is a dragon. According to the legend, Delphi was the haunt of the dragon, Pythio. Baedeker relates, the far-darting Apollo slew 5 days after his birth in the island of Delos, and the god is said to have brought hither his first priest from Crete. I glance at Eleni. She is unperturbed by this version. She gazes calmly across the valley. We saunter up the hill toward the temple of Apollo. A dozen graceful columns are silhouetted against the still blue sky. Eleni admires them excitedly. "It is a scandal with the sky," she says, pleased. "It boils you." She whirls her hand in front of her stomach to illustrate her meaning. We wander over the foundations and come to the section of the temple known as the Aditon, where the priests and the priestesses, of the Oracle of Delphi gave out those amazing prophecies. There's only a square hole in the ground now, but Eleni and I stare steadily and solemnly into it, as if we expect a priestess to appear at any second. I, of course, wish she would. I have a world of questions I'd like to ask her. She was standing on a table with 3 feet, Delaney recounts, and amazingly enough, Baedeker corroborates her, though he would call it a tripod. And under her was the ground, or the earth, if you like, and then she told all these things. Yes, I encourage her. We gave her water to drink, a kind of water that made her tell the fate of mortals, and also she was drunk from smelling burning leaves. There were some leaves who were very strong. They gave a peculiar perfume, and then she gave answers that were very peculiar. Reluctantly, we agree that Aditon, I sound like an old Baedeker myself, and study other sections of the temple. The ancient Greeks had a very big brain to make all this, Eleni declares. Very artistic. And you know, it wasn't only a place of worship, it was the seat of the most ancient confederation of Greek states. After wars, leaders, generals, come here and spoke about all the questions of peace as the four bigs do now. On the slope leading to the road, a scrawny, weather-beaten-faced woman is gathering some sort of wild greens from beneath the marble slabs and stuffing them into a turned-up skirt. Bees buzz over the margaritas. Even among antiquities, life goes on, comments Eleni. A donkey sharing his back among a young girl with yellow-brown eyes and yellow-brown hair and a lovely brown dress and 2 large bags of wheat appears upon the road, and I move suddenly to ride him. The girl, smiling shyly, says she is taking the wheat to a mill on that stream, of which I can catch only silver glimpses in the bottom of the canyon, but I may ride him until we reach the path that plunges down the gorge. The saddle is square and built of wood. Slowly, 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 the donkey and I sway down the highway. I'm glad I'm not racing with a snail. I wouldn't have a chance. Not a chance. At the path, I gladly return the donkey to the girl. My heart goes out to her. How she will ever get that wheat to the mill before it sprouts is beyond me. But even more puzzling and distressing is how Greece will ever get anywhere on donkey back, for the girl is not the only Greek using that mode of transportation to go to a mill or a village or even a city. Thousands of Greeks are. But we come to the town of Arahova quickly by jeep and stop to buy hand-woven rugs. Eleni needs 2 for her house, and I want 4 to carry home as presents. After being torn among dozens of patterns, we begin to make our choices, and then the serious business of price begins. The woman who is waiting on us and Elena start the discussion in fairly normal tones, but soon they are shouting at each other. It is terrible. Momentarily, I expect them to draw knives. They shake their heads. They waggle their heads. They scream. I am frightened, first for the clerk and then for Eleni, especially when several other women who have been standing by begin to scream too. Timidly, I creep forward and pull at Eleni's sleeve. I want to pay her what she asks, I say. Her black eyes spitting with fury, she turns upon me. Let me do my business. I creep back into my corner. Finally, it is settled and without bloodshed. $1 has been knocked off my purchase of 4 rugs and 1 off of Eleni's 2. There seems a slight discrepancy somewhere, but far be it from me to mention it. The Valley of Thebes between its lolling hills is beautiful today after the rain. I look at the small, even patches into which it is divided. I think of small, smart linoleum in a block pattern of 3 colors, the errant green of new wheat, the dark green of onion tops, broad beans and garlic, and the black brown of freshly turned earth. I'm sorry for the shepherds and sheep trying to find grass on strips still untilled, for they are few and widely scattered. Of the 5 flocks I see with 1 sweep of my eye, 3 are cropping along the narrow barren shoulders of the highway. Look, I yell at Eleni as I see sheep with pink faces. Yes, they have been marked for the Easter market, she answers calmly. Every Greek will have a, how you call it, barbecued sheep on Easter morning. It is the custom here. But Eleni and I do not wait for Easter to eat sheep. At the very next town, we sit at a table on the sidewalk and stuff ourselves with it while a whole dead lamb hangs at the restaurant door and fixes us oddly with his round black eyes. I feel uncomfortable. Perhaps it is his child or brothers or sisters whom I'm enjoying so. Eleni, though, has no qualms. She cleans her plate and announces, "This is better than Easter." "What about Lent?" I ask. Don't you fast for Lent?" "Oh, my God, no. I fast enough during occupation never to have to fast again." We rattle on toward Athens. Everything we pass seems new, exciting, foreign. We pass a pig with a heavy chain about its neck, staked to a stop. We see several dozen gigantic brown vultures, or at least we decide they are vultures, never having seen vultures and never having seen anything like these creatures before, tearing the last shreds of flesh from the carcasses of two horses, which no doubt have died of starvation. Costa honks the horn, and they rise up slowly like cub planes and soar above our heads. I am terrified of them. They could easily tear us to pieces and leave our limbs to whiten like those of the unfortunate horses. A little further on, we come abreast of a man walking beside a donkey laden with two barrel-sized rolls of purple and orange blankets. I think they are for sale, but Eleni says no. He is a bridegroom, and the blankets are his dowry. They are hand-woven and look thick and lushly soft. A Greek soldier stops us once more to examine our identification papers and to search the jeep. Gravely, he studies my passport, and miserably I watch him, for my passport is a humiliation to me. Not only does my picture fail to do me any justice, it definitely libels me. Nobody could look as old and infirm as I do in it and be allowed to leave his country. I had it taken at Woolworth's, four for a quarter, and never did I save money more foolishly. If I had only realized that more men were going to look at it than ever looked at the Mona Lisa, I would have had it made life-size by Cecil Beaton and cut down to fit the passport. Also, I would have had my mother bear me at least a decade later. I don't know what she was thinking of to bring me into the world at such an ungodly early year. The soldier flips the pages back and forth, a heavy scowl on his face. He cannot read English, I'm sure, but he won't admit it. For some time he ponders the word Savannah, and the place where I was born. He pronounces it slowly, Savannah. Yes, I say. He closes the passport and hands it back to me. Okay, Miss Savannah, he says and smiles, and I, too, smile. In fact, I laugh out loud. I feel like an Atlantic City bathing beauty, which is the most exhilarating and extraordinary way I ever did feel. Eleni offers him a cigarette as he takes her identification card. He refuses. I am surprised, for I have heard so much about the low morals of Greek officials. I expect them to accept anything, and certainly cigarettes. It's fine that he refuses, I say to Eleni. It shows he is honest and will not be bribed. Eleni grins. You are very much mistaken. It only shows that he does not smoke. Ah, these Greeks. I'll never understand them. They will always be Greeks to me. End of chapter 16.